Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this hour we're casting our glance back at 2018 to talk with several IPR reporters about some of the notable Iowa news stories they covered in the past year. Molly Tibbetts. We know that name well, a murder victim we remember somberly from 2018, a 20-year-old University of Iowa student last seen jogging in the southeast Iowa town of Brooklyn, Iowa, missing for more than a month, a massive manhunt for her before her body was discovered on August 21st. IPR reporter Kate Payne followed this case from its origins as a missing persons case through to the court proceedings, and she will continue to follow this trial. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us, what happened in this heart-wrenching case that also gained national attention?
Yeah, so Molly Tibbetts went missing. She was a University of Iowa student, and almost immediately her story really spread across the state and across the country. For a time this summer, you couldn't go much of anywhere in Iowa without seeing her face on a flyer or a sign. And ultimately, a suspect came forward and led investigators to Molly's body. And that suspect is 24-year-old Christian Behana Rivera. Investigators believe that he stabbed and killed Molly. They also believe that he was in the United States without documentation. And that aspect of the case really escalated and caught the eye of politicians, leaders here in the state and across the country.
And tragically, we have to say, used as a political football, for whoever's purposes it suited.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say.
Mm-hmm. You spoke with some Brooklyn residents about their views on immigration, including a hardware store owner in Brooklyn, Rusty Clayton. Let's listen.
I think illegal immigration's rampant throughout the whole country, and we have to address that. But you kind of feel that your own little community is safe. You know, you kind of expect it maybe in Des Moines or Iowa City or Cedar Rapids, someplace where there's a lot of industry and stuff. But in a small town, you didn't really expect that kind of thing.
Right. And Kate, covering this really struck the community hard, didn't it?
It did. It did. It really exposed a lot of divisions in the community of Brooklyn and across the country. It is important to point out, Ben, despite the concerns of folks like Rusty Clayton and others, research shows that places with larger numbers of immigrants don't have significantly higher rates of crime. But there are certainly a lot of concerns from folks who think that there are too many immigrants in the country, legal and illegal.
Mm-hmm. So, Kate, what is the status of this trial now? What can we expect in terms of what's going to happen in 2019?
So as of right now, Christian Behana Rivera has pleaded not guilty. He does face a first-degree murder charge, which would carry mandatory life sentence if he is convicted. Right now, he's scheduled to have that trial in April of this year, so we are waiting for that.
Let's talk about another case that you you covered. This one definitely related to immigration, a controversy that's been in our country for years. In May, federal law enforcement officials arresting 32 workers in a raid at a concrete factory in the southeast Iowa town of Mount Pleasant. Tell us some background there.
That's right. So these were folks who were working at the Midwest Precast Concrete Plant in Mount Pleasant and were arrested there. Had a huge impact for their affected families. For many of these families, the workers were some of the primary breadwinners, really supporting their families financially, apart from, you know, the loss of a parent. In the months since then, most of the workers were able to be released on bond, and so they've been able to return to their families, not work necessarily, but at least be at home and preparing for the legal cases that comes next. But we do know that 5 workers have been deported and 3 are still facing criminal immigration charges.
Kate, and I was really interested in going back to a clip of your reporting when you talked to some of the people in Mount Pleasant. You spoke with a 15-year-old, Oscar Lopez, whose stepfather was arrested. Listen to this emotional appeal that he brings out based on what you just said.
I think of him as the hardest working man there is. He just tried to get a roof over our head, food to us, everything, like, give us the best life there could be.
Okay, so in many of these cases, people who were taken, arrested in this raid, still in limbo.
Absolutely, and you can hear the emotion in Oscar Lopez's voice. And something that we found was that children that were affected by this raid were especially impacted. And many of their families, the children were the ones with the greatest English proficiency. Mm. And so they were sort of put in the middle of this, of trying to speak for their families, trying to be on the phone with the lawyer, speaking to local community groups about what their needs were, really taking on a lot of responsibility with their parents being taken out of their lives.
Kate Payne, before we go, let's go back 10 years ago. You were not at Iowa Public Radio,
no.
But we had a momentous floods in 2008, and you in 2018 covered the 10-year anniversary of this natural disaster for us. Remind us again. It's been 10 years. Hard to believe that it's been 10 years, but remind us just how catastrophic these floods were.
The scale is almost difficult for me to comprehend. Just tremendously impactful for people in their homes, being flooded, but also businesses. The University of Iowa here in Iowa City was deeply impacted. Maybe the most dire impacts, though, were to the city of Cedar Rapids, where there was an estimated $5.4 billion of damage there alone. We also had billions of dollars of damage to crops, and you saw impacts to major roads, to wastewater facilities, city halls, government buildings, libraries, just huge, huge impacts.
Right. I certainly have stark memories of that time and displacing, just in Cedar Rapids alone, some 10,000 residents. Another statistic, that submerging more than 1,100 city blocks. That's amazing.
It's staggering.
How did you look at this story then 10 years later and see how it had reshaped Cedar Rapids, for instance?
Sure. And it's amazing to walk down in downtown Cedar Rapids and see what's still there and think of, oh my gosh, this, one of my favorite restaurants was totally underwater.
Right.
It's so difficult to comprehend that. But what has been amazing is the investment that's stayed in downtown Cedar Rapids and the reinvestment that's happened. You still have an incredible amount of industry in the downtown area, on the river, Quaker Oats, Cargill, many city office buildings and city hall, are still on the banks of the river, if not on Mays Island and in the middle of the river as they were. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing a lot of growth there.
Mm-hmm. What about the long sought after federal support to help build a permanent flood management system in Cedar Rapids?
Sure. And so that was a huge development that came this summer that even a couple of years ago was not thought to be guaranteed.
A long time coming,
but we did get the announcement of $117 million from the federal government, a huge win for the city of Cedar Rapids that really promised businesses and residents in the downtown, we're going to get this, trust us,
right.
Reinvest, bring your businesses back, we're going to get there. And so a lot of the planning for that permanent flood protection really came together this summer. Construction is underway. The city has a plan, has dedicated hundreds of millions of dollars to that project. There's still a funding gap, but the city's on its way to get that under construction.
All right. Iowa Public Radio's Kate Payne, thanks for taking us back to some of the stories, very important stories you covered in 2018. We appreciate it, Kate.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, reviewing some of the most notable stories of 2018 with our IPR reporters. Joining us now, Katie Pikus, IPR's Western Iowa reporter. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
So let's delve into politics. It was Pretty interesting. Thought not to be interesting because this is the 4th District of Iowa and Steve King has held it for so long. And we had two of Iowa's 4 congressional districts flipping into Democratic hands, the 1st and the 3rd districts in the midterms. Not, however, with the district in the west and northwest part of the state held by Congressman Steve King. This is an incumbent who has vanquished all challengers for that seat for more than 15 years. Democrat J.D. Scholten, not expected to have much of a chance this go-around, but Katie, he came very close, didn't he?
He did. He came very close. He pulled in 47% of the vote to King, who received 50.3% of the vote, and it's the closest election win King has ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. So what made J.D. Scholten such a strong challenger at this time?
You know, he was campaigning around the district doing a 39-county tour. He did that 3 times, twice in a large Winnebago RV. What happened kind of towards the end, the last couple weeks or so leading up to the election, there was news of corporate political action committees withdrawing their financial support from King. Steve Stivers, the chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee, he called him out on Twitter, saying some recent comments on race were inappropriate. And during that time, J.D. Scholten actually pulled in a lot of money from outside organizations. He really outraised King. I think he got about $3 million to King, who got somewhere in the neighborhood close to $1 million. And I think all of that just, it really reshaped things and brought Scholten closer to victory, but not quite there, since mm-hmm. King did pull in a win.
Mm-hmm. What were the issues discussed in that 4th district race?
Everything from immigration to abortion, where Scholten kind of took a stance in the middle, where King kind of stuck to all of his principles. And the tariffs were a big issue at the time, too, with King standing by the president and Scholten saying, you know, who is fighting for the farmers? I think those were kind of 3 of the biggest ones.
Mm-hmm. So Steve King remains congressman for the 4th district in Iowa. How did he pull it off, Katie?
You know, he does continue to have a strong base of supporters here in northwest to western Iowa, where people, you know, as he says, just know who he is. And after he won, he spoke to supporters in Sioux City. He talked about how, despite all of the criticism, reports, and allegation that he received, that he faced leading up to the election, he said, you know, people in the district know who he is.
You knew the truth all along, and you guarded my back. You guarded at the coffee shops, you guarded at the dinner table, you guarded at a church, you prayed for this campaign. And that's the margin, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. Margin's prayer. In fact, I think we might have lost in a landslide if it hadn't been for prayer.
Okay, Steve King, congressman of Iowa's 4th District, winning his seat as an incumbent, unlike 2 other Republican congressmen in Iowa in the 1st and 3rd District. Katie, let's move on to medical marijuana. We have a new medical cannabis program beginning in Iowa. It began in late November. Tell us about it.
Right, so in the last month of 2018, so December 1st, the state launched its medical cannabis program, and people with, you know, a range of medical conditions approved by the state, like seizures, cancer, untreatable pain, they now have cards and they can buy different forms of medical cannabis oil that have also been approved by the state. And there are 5 dispensaries. 2 are managed by Iowa's only medical marijuana manufacturer, MedPharm Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And you actually spoke with people directly impacted by this change, right?
I did. I spoke with a father and his son at the opening at the Sioux City dispensary, William Rose, who's a caregiver for his 13-year-old son, Christian. He was getting medical marijuana drops that go under the tongue for Christian, who has seizures. And William talked about why they're excited about the program.
We don't have to go to Colorado every 3 months. It was, we'd have to, you know, get out a stack of cash and cross through Nebraska, and supposedly we'd be okay with our card, and as long as we followed the Iowa's law, but, you know, that's still, well, it's federally illegal to be, you know, crossing state lines, and, you know, for a kid. And It was kind of terrifying. But yeah, we can get it now, so it's pretty good.
Okay, William Rose, a caregiver for his 13-year-old son who has seizures and hopefully be helped by this new medical marijuana product. Katie, we should, well, let me ask, in Northwest Iowa, covering this, what has been the reception there otherwise?
Well, we know that there's a lot less people registered for the program in Northwest Iowa than there are in Des Moines and any of the other cities involved. I think that there's still a lot more information that needs to get out there, and that MedPharm Iowa says that it's trying to do to fill in the gaps in any misinformation that might be out there about the products.
One thing we should probably note, Katie, about the product is these products here in Iowa, according to law, have very little of the THC. This is the substance that makes a person high. What here is the main active ingredient is CBD, right? The therapeutic use of that.
Right, and it's only, as well as THC, which there's only 3% of in the product.
Katie Pikus, IPR's Western Iowa reporter. Katie, I want to mention a bit of internal Iowa Public Radio news made in 2018. IPR's Western Iowa reporter, that position created in 2018, and you are the first one to occupy that. And we're so glad you have, Katie, and look forward to your reporting in 2019.
I look forward to it, too, and thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this hour's quest to remind ourselves of the top stories from the past year, before we get too far into the new year, I'm joined by IPR legislative reporter Katarina Sestarek. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk politics briefly. First of all, of course, we've been talking all this hour in with other reporters about the major theme in 2018, women and politics. Iowa now has its two first female members of the U.S. House in our state's history, also electing for the first time a female governor, Kim Reynolds. Quite a year for women in the state, in state politics. I know you covered the Cindy Axne race. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, Cindy Axne, she was in a really tight race with Republican former Congressman David Young. He had represented the 3rd District of Iowa for 2 terms, and she came out there. She won a primary against 2 other men, and then she took on David Young in the general election. People were really excited about her, and she was able to beat him by a very small margin. Here's Cindy Axne in her victory speech on election night.
I'm interested in solving problems and making sure that we bring opportunity to the people back here in our corner of the state and to this entire state in general. And because of that, I have not taken one penny from a corporate PAC because I'm out there to work for you.
And Abby Finkenauer in the 1st District also unseated a Republican incumbent that night. And now Iowa has a split congressional delegation. Also, the Iowa legislature saw a record number of women elected that election night as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about a legislative story here in Iowa that gained a national spotlight when our legislature passed one of the strictest abortion laws in the country. Tell us about it.
Late one night at the legislature, lawmakers passed what's called the fetal heartbeat abortion bill. It bans most abortions after as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. So it's considered one of the strictest abortion laws in the country. And Iowa was really in the national spotlight when that happened. Some lawmakers said they wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that allows abortions essentially to be accessed by women in the country. And Reynolds signed the bill at the very end of the session. And so here's Governor Kim Reynolds talking about that.
I believe that all innocent life is precious and sacred. And as governor, I have pledged to do everything in my power to protect it.
And so I am here to tell Governor Reynolds, we will see you in court.
And that second voice was Susanna DeBaca. She was the Planned Parenthood of the Heartland president at the time. So right now, that law is still wrapped up in a lawsuit by Planned Parenthood and the ACLU.
Okay, so we'll look forward to further coverage of that issue in 2019. Katerina, a theme in several Iowa political stories from 2018, sexual harassment. Tell us about the instances where sexual harassment and misconduct during this new Me Too era found its way into our politics.
Yeah, so state government is still grappling with this in Iowa. In 2018, in March, Senate Republican leader Bill Dix resigned hours after a video was posted online that appeared to show him kissing a lobbyist at a bar. And even before that, some had called on him to resign because in 2017, there was a nearly $2 million sexual harassment settlement with a former Senate staffer. And because of his handling of that, some people were already calling on him to resign. So that was a very abrupt change in Senate leadership. And it sort of left, you know, it was just sort of another sexual misconduct incident that happened at the State House. And then later that month, Governor Reynolds fired Iowa Finance Authority Director Dave Jamieson, who is also a longtime friend of hers, because two of his employees said he sexually harassed them. The governor eventually ordered an investigation, and then there was an outside law firm that reported that that there was harassment that occurred. And that sort of led to the state clarifying its process for employees to report harassment, because at that point, these two employees had reported the harassment directly to the governor. And so they're trying to make it clear, make a clearer path for employees to report that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Also, later in the year, well, this is a story that continued on later into the year, but Nate Bolton, a state senator, dropped out of the Democratic primary for governor, right?
Right. He dropped out of the primary after the Des Moines Register reported that women were accusing him of sexual harassment. But then he said he would stay in the Senate. One woman filed an ethics complaint with the Senate, but recently the ethics committee dismissed it because the allegations were from before he was a senator, and they just said they couldn't address it was just not in their jurisdiction to address incidents from before he was a senator. And at this point, we're still waiting to hear. We don't know if his boss, essentially, the Senate Democratic leader, Janet Peterson, will assign him to committees in the upcoming legislative session. And if he's not assigned to committees, that will greatly hamper what he's able to do at the legislature.
Okay. Katerina Sestarek, IPR legislative reporter, reaching back to 2018 and looking at many of the stories that we'll be dealing with also in 2019. Katerina, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, I'll share an excerpt from one of my most memorable interviews from 2018, a conversation with an Iowa woman who survived human trafficking. Then I'll talk with Clay Masters about his reporting on the fascinating midterm election campaign. And I'll talk with Amy Mayer about the implications of the Farm Bill passed by Congress that was in December, and with her about how some small towns in Iowa are achieving brain gain. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more River to River from Iowa Public Radio News after this short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll continue this hour of asking our reporters to recall some of the most notable stories they covered in 2018 right after I share a selection of my own from this program. It's not a cheery story, but it is a story of courage. Back in July, we spent an hour here on River to River exploring the scourge of human trafficking. Human trafficking, illegally transporting people for forced labor or commercial sex, it's one of the world's largest criminal industries. It's a form of human slavery found in every state, including here in Iowa. Now, back in July, on that show, among my guests, an Iowa woman who survived human trafficking. Here's part of a conversation I had with Christina Glacken. Christina was abducted and trafficked for commercial sex some 12 years ago when she was an 18-year-old in Las Vegas. And in this excerpt, Christina describes how she began to realize it was time to plot an escape.
You had been drugged.
Mm-hmm.
You'd been starved.
Yeah. You agreed for one night. What happened after that?
Well, after that, the next morning, I remember watching him. I don't know exactly, but it was drugs. I believe it was like a crack rock. I was watching him take a razor blade to the outside of it, and I was saying to him, you know, so when do I get to leave? And he said, you know, we had something else come up, and $400 isn't enough now. And I was just like, I was becoming so numb, but I was fighting. I was fighting. So then one night turned into going into the third day, and they thought I was broken down enough or something. I don't know. They left me alone with this other girl. This girl had been so mean to me when they were present, but when they left, she told me that they were planning on killing me because of all the issues I was causing and that I had to get out. And I was like, how? There was no contact with the outside world. They had taken it, and I was so full of fear and just lacking a will to live. At this point, I just wanted to let my mom know I was alive and just hear her voice again. So she said, you got to start telling these men what's happening. She said, because either they're going to kill you or you're going to just submit to them. She's like, and if you do that, she's like, you're going to end up like me. And she told me she had been there for 2 years.
In that conversation with Christina Glacken on this program from July of 2018, she went on to describe her miraculous and harrowing escape. Christina Glacken, a human trafficking survivor, an Iowa woman with the courage to share her agonizing trauma from 12 years ago on this broadcast. Today, you'll be happy to know Christina is a mother and an activist, and need I say, an inspiration.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The year 2018, fading fast into the distance, but not so fast. This hour, we're checking in with several of our IPR reporters and asking them to recall a couple of their stories that stick out from the past year. Clay Masters joins me, host of Morning Edition, of course, and Iowa Public Radio reporter. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
Well, we've got to dig into politics right away here. What themes in 2018, what stories did you focus on as the midterm election year developed?
I spent most of 2018 focused on races for Congress here in the state of Iowa. The governor's race was a big one, and also was getting quite a bit of vertigo as 2020 potential hopefuls for president were in the state testing the waters ahead of the caucuses. So when I look back on 2018, what a bizarre year for Iowa politics, but I guess you can say that kind of every year, right? I want to start with a story I did at the outset of last year. It was almost a year ago that I was working on this story. There's a state lawmaker from Northwest Iowa, or I should say there was a state lawmaker from Northwest Iowa, David Johnson, a Republican, had been on the local co-chair of several presidential caucus campaigns here. He was with George W. Bush and Mitt Romney, I believe. And in 2016, he said he was done with the Republican Party because of Donald Trump, then a candidate, was looking to be the nominee, or he might have even become the nominee. And he was one of these people that we dubbed a never-Trumper, mm-hmm. somebody that could not support the president. And at the outset of 2018, he was convinced that he was going to run for his seat in very Republican Northwest Iowa as an independent. And I interviewed then Senator Johnson and then went up into his district and chatted with people in the district. And, you know, he was going to go at it. He was saying he thought he could still win. And then, of course, what happened? He decided that he was not going to run. And so I just think it's interesting to see how much many lawmakers at the state level in Congress are really embracing the president.
Okay, so that your conversation with David Johnson at to start the year, more or less, 2018, really set a theme, didn't it, Clay? We have a considerable headwind for Republicans in the midterm year, and also the quandary for Republicans with all of our Congress members of Congress up for re-election. What to do, the degree to which, and if they should embrace Trump, right?
That's right, and the two big races here in Iowa in Congress were former Congressman David Young and former Congressman Rod Blum. These were two congressmen who were elected in 2014. We regularly talk about, and many analysts during Politics Day on River to River talk about, Iowa likes its incumbents. Mm-hmm. And Rod Blum, the congressman from the 1st District, which includes Cedar Rapids and Dubuque and Waterloo, he was very much embracing Trump. My colleague Kate Payne covered the president when he came to Piasta, and Rod Blum was on stage talking about, supporting the president and congratulating him for basically holding tough and implementing these tariffs and not backing down. This is the same time you had Republican Congressman David Young, which represents the 3rd District, including Des Moines and Council Bluffs and a lot of Southwest Iowa. He was at the state fair basically saying, I don't support tariffs, and really walking this line of embracing the president. And then in Council Bluffs, a couple months after his soapbox speech at the Des Moines Register soapbox at the state fair, he was on stage with the president. Mm-hmm. And he came up on stage, he talked, and President Trump said, a vote for me is a vote for David. And we've had all this analysis, especially at the national level, from folks at NPR that are saying a lot of Congress that's left, the people that won their seats weren't the moderates, the never Trumpers, but these congressmen and women who really embraced the president. Well, as we saw, both Congressman David Young and Congressman Rod Blum fully embraced the president ahead of the election, and they both lost to Democratic women. Now, of course, the 1st District is represented by Congresswoman Finkenauer, and the 3rd District is represented by Congresswoman Axne. So, again, Iowa politics.
Right,
you
right.
Never and, really know what's going to come.
And embraces it is an interesting word, because the president used that in saying that those who lost in some cases across the country, they lost because they did not embrace him. So that's interesting. We also had a gubernatorial race. Kim Reynolds appointed after Governor Branstad left to be U.S. ambassador to China, prevailing over Fred Hubble. I guess, Clay, somewhat of a surprise considering the headwind Republicans were facing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I looked back at some of the stories I was working on during the summer months, and, you know, this was a really crowded primary field for the Democratic gubernatorial election. That primary had 7 or 8, and of course there was the scandal with Senator Nate Bolton, and that was a time when all of our attention was going to the Democratic field there. And so the Democrats really had a lot of momentum out of the primary, and Fred Hubble spent a lot of money, became the nominee. And there were all these polls that were coming out saying that, you know, Fred Hubble had the lead in some of them. A lot of them were within the margin of error. And Governor Kim Reynolds did not face a primary challenger. She did early on in Ron Corbett, but he didn't have enough signatures to get on that primary ballot. And Fred Hubble spent a lot of debates preparing to debate Kim Reynolds, really. And, you know, you talk about the support and the embrace for the president. And Governor Kim Reynolds, it was seen to be, you know, kind of a vulnerable position. And Governor Kim Reynolds was up on stage at that same rally in Council Bluffs where former Congressman David Young was speaking. And she was fully embracing the president. And this was soon after the Supreme Court justice hearings where Brett Kavanaugh and his past was dragged into the light. We all remember that. And here's what she was saying up on stage that day.
Thank you for cutting taxes for hardworking Iowans, for eliminating senseless regulations that stifled innovation and jobs, for standing strong with Justice Kavanaugh and appointing conservative judges to the court.
Clay, to finish up here, we're diving into a new campaign season, less than 13 months until the Iowa caucuses. I can't believe I just said that. February 3rd, 2020. What are the early signs for you of the character of this caucus campaign season? We could have a huge field of Democratic candidates.
Yeah, and just to kind of a snapshot of that, last weekend I was following Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts to a couple of her stops in Storm Lake and in Des Moines, and the crowds were pretty big. Many people were saying it feels really early, but they're eager to start hearing from the candidates, because the one thing that resonated with everybody who was at these Elizabeth Warren events was they wanted to find somebody who could beat Donald Trump in 2020.
Clay Masters, host of Morning Edition and Iowa Public Radio reporter. We look forward to your coverage in this coming year, as always. Clay Masters, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're checking in with IPR reporters about important stories they covered in 2018 and the degree to which those stories, those themes, might carry over into our present year, 2019. Amy Mayer is with us, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Always good to have you on the show, Amy.
Thanks for having me back, Ben.
Well, let's talk about the major story, one of the major stories that we covered several times, and we've heard much of your reporting about it from the last year, the Farm Bill. It was not until December that Congress finally, and this was with strong bipartisan support, settled on a Farm Bill, right?
That's right. And even though it was late at the end of the year, it was still faster than some farm bills of the past.
Right. $867 billion farm bill. How did Congress finally settle on this particular farm bill?
As happened in the last go-round, the Republican Party had some tensions within it in the House. And so where the Senate had come up with a bipartisan bill that they were pretty sure they could get through pretty early in the spring, the House had a bill that just it didn't go anywhere on the first try. The reasons for that had less to do with agriculture and more to do with other things happening in politics. But nonetheless, the first farm bill vote in the House went down. So that was the first delay. Then the House got a bill together, but there was huge differences between changes that the House, in particular House Republicans, wanted to make, especially to the food stamps or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It took a long time for the four leaders, Republican and Democrat from the House Ag Committee, Republican and Democrat from the Senate Ag Committee, to finally work out enough of those kinks that they could bring to the floor a bill that both houses would pass.
Mm-hmm. Politics always entering the farm bill, as you mentioned, many details there from 2018. But I wonder if in particular, the president's trade war with China figured into how the farm bill was shaped.
I think it did for sure, because one of the things that farm bill lobbyists always say is that farmers need certainty. They can't count on the weather. They can't count on market volatility. So they need to know what the federal government is proposing for farm support programs, for conservation, for rural development. And with all of the tariffs and the changes in export markets that were unfolding during the debate over the farm bill, there were several efforts to make changes within this farm bill that would help farmers weather the current trade conditions and also set a stage for a better situation for export markets for farmers moving ahead.
Mm-hmm. And we know that farmers and ranchers have seen steep declines in commodity prices as a result of this trade dispute with China. Hopefully that will be resolved soon. But, I mean, farmers in 2019 sort of cast that forward about the worries that farmers may have with their commodity prices because of the way commodities are traded. Not everyone felt the pain in 2018, right?
Not everyone, although many of the farmers that I talked to felt that because it was hitting certain things especially hard, in particular soybeans and pork, there were ripple effects throughout the rest of the farm economy. Of course, there are scenarios in which one person's pain is somebody else's gain, and we did see a little bit of that. But I think the history of 2018 for many farmers is coupled now with this shutdown that has been the launch of 2019. And so this theme of uncertainty, which was partially because of the farm bill last year, is extending into 2019, even though we have a signed farm bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to sum up this huge farm bill, the impact on Iowa agriculture, in a few words?
There'll be some more money for conservation programs. There will be some trade relief money that comes to Iowa that's connected to the Farm Bill. And I think we're going to see some rural infrastructure projects that will get either loans or grants from the Farm Bill. But it's important to note that for the most part, with the exception of the trade relief, those are all continuations of things that we already were seeing in Iowa from previous Farm Bills. Mm-hmm.
Amy Mayer, when we look back at your reporting in 2018, we have to call attention to this tragic, this sorrowful story, the murder of a civil engineering student from Spain attending Iowa State University, a young woman, a big 12 women's golf champion, as a matter of fact.
That's right. Celia Barquina Rosamena came to Iowa State on a full golf scholarship from Spain. She was a celebrated golfer. She had been selected as the 2018 Iowa State Female Athlete of the Year, and she was just really widely loved and celebrated. She had completed her Big 12 or her NCAA eligibility and was finishing her, was going to be her last semester as a civil engineering student at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm. And what happened?
She was out golfing on a Monday morning, and some other golfers had seen her. They were behind her on the course, and then they came upon a hole where they saw a golf bag that they thought was hers that had been abandoned. And so these golfers called the clubhouse at the course, and then the course ultimately contacted the Ames Police Department, which held a press conference the next day to tell everybody what had happened.
Officers responded to the golf course and began to search for the missing golfer. At approximately 11:03 a.m., Coldwater staff alerted officers to a body found in the water next to the number 9 tee box.
That was Ames Police Department Commander Jeff Huff, and he went on to describe the actual method or the cause of death. From there, when they had found the body, police and a sheriff's department dog from Boone County were able to find their way to a homeless encampment where a person who was there told law enforcement about a different man who had made comments about wanting to hurt women. Ultimately, that man, whose name is Colin Richards, was apprehended, and he was ultimately charged with murder.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be hearing more about that case in 2019 as that case and that court case, the trial proceeds, right?
That's right.
Talking with Amy Mayer and our other reporters about stories from 2018 of significance. Amy, in 2018, you also reported on an interesting positive story, how some small towns are achieving brain gain, not brain drain, as we usually hear, but brain gain. Explain what you focused on here and what's driving it.
The idea here is that brain gain is essentially the opposite. Instead of people growing up in a community, leaving for college, and not coming back, which is the traditional brain drain, people are wanting to move to a community, whether it's the one they grew up in and left or one that they haven't ever lived in before. And there are a lot of initiatives really throughout the country, but especially in Iowa, to try to help smaller communities figure out what it would take to entice new people into a community. I actually started this story because I'd heard about a program in Northeast Iowa called Community Heart and Soul, mm-hmm. which is a very specific set of meetings and conversations that are facilitated in a community so that it can really identify what makes that community tick and how might they use those characteristics to attract other people. I learned about this from Jason Nisis, who works at the Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque and coordinates Community Heart and Soul.
Let's build our community, let's grow our community around these core values and make sure we strengthen those things as a way to increase the impact of both the private and philanthropic dollars that go into every small town.
It's a very interesting development because we've heard about the hollowing out of rural Iowa, the small towns. And here is a lesson or a series of lessons about how small town rural areas can thrive. And what are the takeaways from the instances that you reported on, perhaps lessons for other rural communities?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see what things really worked. I mean, one town in particular that I'm thinking of, Bellevue, had townwide fiber optic. And that might seem like a really big investment to make for a small number of people, but it's something that makes business way more viable, mm-hmm. Which can help with redevelopment in a downtown area. And it also means that a professional who is able to telecommute but relies on high-speed internet might be willing to consider that location. Some of the other takeaways were making sure that the economic base of a community is expanding rather than contracting, so attracting a manufacturing business or, you know, supporting small new businesses in a downtown neighborhood. I was a little bit surprised to learn that revitalizing downtowns was something many communities wanted, but was not necessarily something that someone looking at a place to live was going to require. So it really had a lot to do with how the individuals in that community feel about their town, what they love, and how much they're able to demonstrate that dedication in a way that is attractive to newcomers.
I really love the fact that you focused on this bright story amid news that is predominantly less than bright. Amy Mayer, thank you so much for recalling some stories you covered in 2018, and we look forward to your reporting in 2019. Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
And that does it for our look back at 2018 with IPR reporters. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.